This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Dan Satterberg is going to get a challenger in the race for King County prosecutor, and it is Darren Morris, who is you're a public defender now, right? What decided you to get into this race?
Yeah, well, I was a public defender until I recently resigned to run this campaign full-time. I was a public defender for 20 years, representing clients in King County court and seeing the justice system operate one face at a time. And, of course, as a public defender, I was deeply committed to justice. But as a public defender for 20 years, I've been a minister of justice, just like every other lawyer in that courthouse. And so I care deeply about accountability and public safety and justice and justice reform, and those are the core missions of the prosecutor's office. But
you must feel there's something lacking in Dan Satterberg's approach. When it comes to justice reform, he has been, I mean, considering he used to be a Republican, to be involved, for example, in restorative justice and some of the other programs he started, it seems remarkably left of center. So how do you approach these things?
So, you know, what we have in this county, in spite of the reforms that Mr. Satterberg has promoted around the edges, is a continuing war against poor people, where our criminal justice system, which is supposed to be about due process and the right to a jury trial and protecting public safety, has essentially been co-opted by money interests, essentially, to criminalize homelessness, criminalize poverty, swell up our incarcerated population, which today is 6 times higher than it was in 1970. That's 40% African American, where people are still going to prison for very long sentences for property crimes.
You're saying there's a deliberate policy to imprison more minorities?
Well, that's certainly what's happening. More minorities are being imprisoned by the operation of the law and the way it's implemented. And, you know, Dave, I'm increasingly less concerned about whether it's intentional or whether it's just what's happening. The question is there any urgency about stopping it? Now, if you're a person like Dan Satterberg and you're not operating from specific racial intent, you're not Donald Trump, you're not an out-and-out bigot, but you're the one occupying that space and you have the power to stop it, and you don't talk about systemic racism in the criminal justice system, then I don't really much care whether you're operating from that specific intent or not. The effect is the same.
Tell me how it works, this systemic racism, which we've talked about for a long time. The statistics certainly indicate that there is a disproportionate number of minorities being incarcerated, but we have removed the marijuana laws now, so that's no longer there. We've been through this whole Department of Justice reform with the Seattle Police Department. And I'm not sure how you'd rate the King County Sheriff's Office, but we've paid attention to these things. And yet there is somebody or something still determined to make sure we can put away as many minorities as possible. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, it works on two levels. One is at the level of implicit bias, where, you know, people have these prejudices, and we all have them. You know, people in minority communities have them as well. I have them. You have them. Implicit biases where we just, without even fully realizing it, we treat people of different races differently. And that happens every day in King County Court. People come to their sentencing hearings or their bail hearings. They come in the vestiges of slavery, shackles, you know, red jumpsuits, and they get different outcomes. Not because the judge is up there wearing a Klan hat, but because we all have these prejudices and we're not working hard enough to get around them.
Well, is it race or is it money? I mean, I know the two are intertwined, but I mean, the determining factor many times is what kind of lawyer you can afford and how long you can afford to fight a charge.
Yeah, and it's both. I mean, that was the second point I was getting to. It's that we're criminalizing poverty and turning a blind eye to how heavily and negatively that impacts African-American people in particular, but also people of other races and people with other vulnerabilities. Bail system is where this happens the most. And if you go watch court any given day, you'll see 30-second, one-minute bail hearings where bail is deliberately requested by the prosecutor's office and set by a judge at a level where the judge knows and the prosecutor knows that indigent, that poor defendant, cannot make that bail. Mm-hmm. So it's a detention order, and which is actually prohibited by our state constitution.
But you also don't want to release somebody who's going to go out and commit a crime again. That's the purpose here, right? So are you saying that bail and these other things are being used just to make a racial point, and it's not being used? Pardon me. Are you saying judges are not doing things for public safety, but rather just to harm somebody based on his skin color or standard of living?
No, I'll tell you what judges are, what's going through a judge's head, and there's a great article that Ron Kessler did where he, on bail, where he released someone for a failure to register as a sex offender charge, didn't put $30,000 bail, and it wasn't warranted, and then that man went out and committed a crime. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a sex crime, but he committed a crime.
Yeah.
And Judge Kessler did a great spotlight on what goes through a judge's mind, and of course a judge is always worrying about what's going to be in the papers the next day. So, you know, that's what's going through a judge's mind. What if I make the wrong decision? How do I protect the public? But what bail is supposed to be is a way to incentivize someone to return to court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a father puts down $1,000 for his boy, and now the community is galvanized around that man to help him come back to court. It's supposed to be an incentive and a means of assuring future appearance. It's not supposed to be a pretext for holding people in jail, and really a pretext for holding mm-hmm. poor people in jail, because guess what? Harvey Weinstein pays that bail. It's only the poor person who doesn't. The Constitution actually says that for those serious crimes, you don't have to do money bail. You just get a detention order. You mm-hmm. just get a straight-up detention order, and the person can't get out for those.
So that would be one reform, to divorce the bail from public safety then. Bail should be simply a way of getting people to show up in court. And if somebody's truly a danger to the community, there are other ways to do that?
Right. There are other ways to do that, and they're not being used right now, and that's very upsetting. There are, and even as a public defender, there are places where I'd like to see, there are places where I'd like to see an increase in some approaches to protect public safety. And one of those is non-bailable detention orders for serious crimes. Those aren't being used by the prosecutor's office right now.
I had
now.
No idea they even existed until you just mentioned them. I figured bail was the only option.
No, I think it's Article 20, or Section 20 of Article 1 of our state constitution, and there was a fairly recent amendment that allows them for any Class A felony where there's a danger to the community. It's mm-hmm. available. It's just not used because, you know, our prosecutor right now is trying to have bail hearings happen in 30 seconds, and if you use that provision, maybe you need to take 2 or 3 minutes. Give someone a little more due process. So it's a little more work, but it absolutely can be done.
I can see where some people listening would worry that based on your approach, you would be soft on criminals. Are you?
I'm absolutely, you know, not soft on criminals. I want to do first and foremost what protects the public and what works. The problem is that if you want to have real public safety, you need accountability running in both directions. Okay? You can't just have a heavy hand. You can't just have the prosecutor applying a heavy hand of accountability against people in the community, taking families apart, removing kids from their parents, sending people off to prison for 5 years for property crimes, and then not holding itself accountable to the public, or not holding the broader law enforcement community accountable to the public. So, you know, really these reforms that I'm talking about are about establishing that reciprocal relationship of accountability that's fundamental to public safety. Because people won't call the police. People won't do neighborhood watch. People won't do prevention if they don't trust in their government and their police. You know, if you're out there watching a car get stolen and you're worried that if you call the police, someone's going to get killed, then that's what's destroying public safety.
Now, so this is the problem. You're saying that the current attitude of the justice system does not make people want to do the things necessary to make their communities safer.
Right. Real deterrence happens from prevention and interception of crimes. This notion of general deterrence that by increasing car theft penalties from 3 to 5 years that we're going to stop car theft, you know, that's not what's going through that person's mind, or he wouldn't be out there trying to steal your car. If he was rational enough to think, am I going to get 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years for this? I mean, that person's already beyond that point. He's worried about whether he's going to get caught. Yeah. He's worried about anyone looking out the window about to call the police. And, you know, there are some areas. We have not enough rape charges being filed right now by Dan Satterberg. And I've talked to a woman who survived a horrible rape several years ago where she was someone apparently slipped something in her drink and she was intoxicated. And you know, she fought as hard as she could for that man to be held accountable. And Mr. Satterberg's office refused to file charges in that case. And there have been other women, and this was written about 7 or 8 years ago, where, you know, the message that these women are being told is, well, you were too drunk. We can't file charges. You don't remember anything. Or, well, you weren't really that drunk, so this wasn't a rape if you weren't that drunk, and sort of a Goldilocks issue where, you know, we're not going to file the charges if you were too drunk, and we're not going to file the charges if you weren't drunk enough. And there's a culture going on in the prosecutor's office where those serious acts of violence and harm against women are not being prosecuted. So I would, when it comes to, but we need to stop criminalizing poverty so that we can truly dedicate ourselves to really prosecuting crimes that impact public safety.
Right? Okay, you've brought up criminalizing poverty a number of times. We're talking about homelessness, I assume?
We are. We're also just talking about more broadly criminalizing. Mm-hmm. We're talking about homelessness, and we're talking about money bail.
Okay, but on the homeless issue,
right?
I've detected people really losing patience with it. They want the tents gone. How would you tackle it? How would you tackle it when neighborhoods have just started calling in anybody who sets up a tent in a right of way, asking that the system do something about trespassers and make it stick?
Yeah. Well, we really do need to address the underlying needs that are driving people into homelessness, and my opponent seems to believe that that is entirely to do with drug addiction. But if you talk to anyone who's working with homeless people, you'll hear and you'll know that what's really driving people into homelessness is housing affordability. And I was out in Bellevue last night where the average income of a single woman is $39,000 a year. People can't make it on that wage. So they're either falling into homelessness or they're housing unstable. And then within that, you know, people are experiencing problems with substance use, and there are problems people have. There are people in the homeless community who are experiencing mental illness as well. Those things can't be ignored, but that's not, you cannot equate the homeless population with those issues. So if we don't have the courage and the commitment to address the underlying problems, we're just not going to get anywhere.
But in the meantime, should people be prosecuted for trespassing?
We need to find a way to hold people accountable for the harm that's being caused to the public. Now, when you talk about trespassing, you know, and a person's homeless, let's get that person somewhere else. Let's, you know, certainly we're not going to have lawlessness, and we're going to be intelligent about where.
But sometimes they don't want to go someplace else. They've found a spot, and it's convenient, and they feel they're not harming anybody. In many cases, they're policing the place in terms of the trash and, you know, waste and stuff like that. But the neighbors just don't feel good about somebody camping in the green space that they consider to be their park.
Right, sure. But our police, you know, are equipped to deal with this, and they know how to take that person and arrest that person and get them somewhere else.
But you're okay with that?
Sure, I'm okay with it. Yeah, I don't. If there's a homeless person on my property, what I would probably do, Dave, is I'd go out and try to talk to that person and get them to move on. You know, I'd check to make sure that my kids were somewhere else. I'd go deal with that myself. I'd do my best to get them to move along. And if I couldn't, I'd get the police involved, or I'd get somebody else, and maybe I'd get the neighborhood. I'd probably try to get the neighborhood together first and see if I couldn't do something. Mm-hmm. And as a last resort, I'd call the police and get that person moved along. And if the police had to arrest that person and take them down to somewhere else, to a homeless shelter or to crisis services, but, you know, that's what should happen. That person shouldn't be detained on a money bail for months in the jail where we're not doing anything fundamentally to address the situation. We're just making it worse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can be intentional and strategic about where people can set up temporarily in camps while we're working to solve the housing crisis. But the jails and the criminal justice system are not the place to do that.
And on property crimes, which is a big problem in Seattle for some reason. I'm not sure why we seem to score so high there, but car thefts, car prowls, burglaries, things like that. you seem to be implying that there is a better way than cracking down. There's a way to enlist the community in cooperating to make sure that these things don't happen. So give me what your vision is. How would that work?
Yeah. You know, and it starts from, and the police will tell you the same thing, that once someone's stolen a car, you know, those are very hard crimes to solve. And it's, again, sending that person away to 5 years, 5 years in prison doesn't accomplish anything. So my vision a little bit starts from my own experience with having had my car stolen, a few years ago. And it wound up in several neighborhoods away. 2 months later, we eventually found it. I thought about what I wanted in that situation at that time. I wanted that person held accountable. I wanted them not to steal my car. I did not want them in prison for 5 years, removed from their community.
You weren't angry with them?
I think I was annoyed. And, I'll recognize that my experience doesn't speak for everybody's experience, right? And when I talked about going out on my front lawn and talking to a homeless guy to get him to move on, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's something I'm comfortable with. I'm not saying everybody should be. Some people have had trauma in their background that I haven't had. I'm just talking about what I felt. But, I was annoyed. When someone broke into my home, I felt
that happened too.
We had a bad 6 months there. So, certainly I felt violated when someone was in my home, and I felt scared. Sure. Felt scared.
Sure.
You know, but in both those cases, I'm sure there was a wave of anger. There was annoyance, and then what did I want? I wanted that person to be held accountable. I wanted to feel safe. We can do that without blowing up the prison population. We don't need the prison population to be 6 times higher today than it was 50 years ago in order to deter people from breaking into my home.
Yeah. No, I would agree. It's the number of people we imprison is amazing, and it's extremely expensive. But you're talking about changing things such that, I'm assuming, that let's assume it was a teenager. That teenager's parents would intervene and make sure that he doesn't do it again. Or the other neighbors who know who this guy is would turn him in and be more cooperative. You're implying that right now that's not what's happening. The communities are not really working the way they should to discourage crime. Is that what you're saying?
Right. And when I say that, I'm not blaming communities, but I think it's very true in America that we've lost some coherence to our communities. We might all be in at night watching television and not connected to each other in a way that we used to be. And in some communities, people are legitimately afraid to call the police if they see a crime in progress. So we need to address that. We need to allow people to feel safe in calling the police.
And so as county prosecutor, then what do you do about that? How do you make people feel that they can trust the police to do the right thing?
Yeah. So, you hold police accountable when they commit crimes. I would have prosecuted Ian Burke.
So your office would take a more proactive approach to prosecuting police officers who mess up.
When we need a different process entirely, this inquest process that we have right now is fundamentally the wrong process. That's a coroner's process not designed to address questions of culpability. So we've got to change that process. But when it's clear, Ian Burke closed the distance on John Williams in about the space of 5 seconds, yeah. And he did so aggressively. And he did so to set up a hostile confrontation against a deaf homeless Native American woodcarver. He was acting in bad faith, no question, and I would have prosecuted him. And when Mr. Satterberg elected not to do so, he created a fracture in this community that we've still not recovered from. So absolutely, when police commit crimes, police need to be held accountable. Just like when anyone commits a crime, they need to be held accountable. And if we don't have that mutuality, then we don't get that public trust. And, part of this I want to make sure that we talk about too then is what happens in our courtrooms once we are holding people accountable. And it can't be that we just delay these cases and delay these cases, which, by the way, wastes a lot of money, how long these cases are taking to get to trial or get resolved. They should be taking about half as much time.
So we're talking about cops?
I'm talking about, now I'm sorry, I was sort of shifting to just talking about anything. When we do when we do file those charges and when we do hold people accountable, what's happening in our courtrooms right now, Dave, is it's really shocking. Cases take 2 years to get through the system. People are held on these money bail, $500,000 that, you know, it might as well be five, and the homeless person can't make that. People are threatened, take this plea or, you know, or we'll hammer you. No one can really go to trial anymore. I talked to a father the other day whose son had shot someone, and he knew his son needed to go to prison, but it was the way it happened. The way it happened was that father did not get a chance to go into court and really talk to the judge at the sentencing hearing about what ought to happen to his kid. The sentence was decided entirely in the prosecutor's office on a negotiated plea where the deal was take 15 years, 20-year-old kid, no prior history of violence. He snapped. He had a mental health break. He got cornered into a bad situation at a basketball game. He pulled out a gun. He needed to go to prison. I mean, look, prison is a horrible place. It's a harmful place, and we need to start from that. But, you know, until we improve that, people also need to be held accountable. So something needed to happen in this case, and the dad knew that. But what he wanted was to have a fair hearing and go talk to the judge about what should happen to his son. And instead, what happened was the prosecutor said, your kid's taking 15 years or we're going to give him 50 because we can. And that's where the sentence got decided. You know, when we talk about open hearings and public justice and due process, that's none of those things.
Shouldn't you also, though, talk to the family of the victim?
Oh, absolutely. That's what the fair hearing is about, so that everyone can come in front of the judge and we have some trust in our judges mm-hmm. to make those fair decisions. And that kind of process and that kind of fairness, those are the same standards that we apply in cases where a police officer shoots someone so that we're not rushing to judgment. But they also need to be the same standards that we apply to that boy and to his father and to that family and to the person who was shot. And this fact that 97% of our cases are getting resolved through plea bargains, which are really plea threats and plea coercion, and only 3% of people even go to jury trial anymore. I mean, how can you have a constitutional right to a jury trial and only 3% of people actually using it?
Well, because I guess a lot of people figure that, heck, I did it and I'm not going to win my case.
And that's great and that's fine. That's plea bargaining. And, you know, plea bargaining is two people want to make a deal and save everybody some time, then absolutely, that's plea bargaining. Take 1 year or we'll give you 30 to the point where even an innocent person would plead guilty. I mean, Dave, if someone...
Do you think that the Dan Satterberg has gotten innocent people to plead guilty just out of fear?
Absolutely he has. I've seen it. You know, I've been a public defender for 20 years and that's what happens. And really, you know, his chief criminal deputy is the one more running the show on that. But of course, the buck stops here and Dan Satterberg's in charge of these things. But it happens in both directions. You know, you'll have someone charged with a robbery and he can plead out to 5 years, or the prosecutor's office will threaten to give him 40. Or the prosecutor's office has a rape case where mm-hmm. the sentence is life in prison and maybe the case starts to have some problems and fall apart a little bit. And now they say to the defendant, you know, well, we've got some problems now. Take a year. And if you don't, we'll give you 50.
And this is a guy who didn't do it?
What happened in reality, Dave, is always between that person and God or whatever higher power you believe. I've been the defense lawyer in those situations looking at it. But what I've seen is people telling me, I didn't do this. I've had a strong belief that they didn't do this. Mm-hmm. And they're saying to me, if my choices are to leave this up, to face 50 years, I can face 50 years, I can go in front of a jury and leave it up to 12 people who I don't know to decide what happened, or I can go back to my family today. You know, I owe it to my kids to be a father. I'm not risking 50 years. So my point is, when we allow justice to be decided under duress, under these kind of threats, and that becomes the norm, when duress and threats and delay and coercion and money bail become the foundation of our justice system instead of the right to the jury trial, then we've lost.
But that's a huge charge to say that the prosecutor's office is using threats to put innocent people in jail. That's not only unconstitutional, but completely immoral. Is that what you're really saying?
You know, and again, Dave, whether prosecutor, the individual prosecutor is doing it deliberately or recklessly concerns me less than the fact that it's happening over and over and over again. The prosecutor's office is routinely threatening people in a plea bargaining situation under conditions.
But presumably that's because there's evidence. Now, I mean there have been cases where a witness lies under oath and is joined by others who lie under oath, and then that person, we've certainly seen the DNA project exonerate people who were put in prison by lying witnesses. That's bad. That's on the witnesses. It's also on the prosecutor, but on the witnesses. Are you saying that the prosecutor, even though he may know better, is just in it to put people away?
Now, usually what happens is the prosecutor, for their own private reasons, is convinced that the person did it. And what happens is that they wind up substituting their own judgment for that of the jury.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the number one reason of wrongful convictions is actually not eyewitness identification. It's false confessions. I talked to one of the exonerees from the Innocence Project Northwest.
Yeah.
He falsely confessed to a rape charge, and he did so because the police told him, look, we've got DNA. We know you did it. And they badgered him. They didn't beat him with a rubber hose or anything, but they badgered him, and he said, well, you know what? I'll just confess. I need this to end. This is too much for me. And tomorrow, the DNA evidence is going to clear me anyway, so I can say whatever, and I'm going to get out of here. Mm. And then he wound up spending 15 years in prison. So, you know, there are cases where it may look like there's evidence. And there are also cases, though, where, there have been cases where the evidence is getting pretty weak, and now the prosecutor just wants the case to go away. They want to get it off their trial calendar.
Yeah.
So one thing I would do would be to centralize control of the plea bargaining function in the prosecutor's office. We cannot have overworked trial deputies with 20 cases scheduled for trial tomorrow under pressure to get cases off their trial calendar through really sort of strong-arm tactics. And I don't think those prosecutors are deliberately trying to convict innocent people. I think those prosecutors are trying to do their job under the things that they've come to believe. I think they're public servants. But what's happening is that these decisions are being made without oversight and accountability, and things are running wild, and innocent people are going to prison, whatever the intention is.
Darren Morris, running for King County Prosecutor. Darren, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.